I'm here at Caliente Pizza Bar, craft beer bar. It's my first time here. They're in Bloomfield on Liberty Avenue, and they have a fantastic craft selection. They've been on my to-do list for quite a while now. And the reason I'm here tonight is because it is part of the Pittsburgh launch of Deschutes Brewery. And I'm here with Eric Frank, who is the guy they send to a new city to launch the brand into the city.
Hey guys, how's it going?
My first question I had when you told me you're the guy that launches new markets is, what are some of the markets you've been in recently launching?
Well, the last 2 years we've been kind of on a tear, really. Last January 2013, we launched the Illinois market. We spent probably 2 weeks in Chicago spreading the gospel and spreading the love of craft beer all over both Chicagoland and all over the state, really. We found a great distributor partner in Wirtz Beverage over there, and that was pretty spectacular. We followed that up later in the year with full-time distribution in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and we also launched Nebraska and Iowa. Roughly the middle of the year. This year, we took on the absolutely enormous market that is known as Ohio, and along with it, Kentucky. We have also now filled out the bottom portion of Pennsylvania with South Central Pennsylvania and now Pittsburgh, actually.
We don't like hearing ourselves as the bottom of Pennsylvania. We're the good side of the state, the western end of the state.
We're actually, so what I really meant there was the southern half of Pennsylvania, actually. Unfortunately, we're not in Scranton or Erie or State College yet, but Pittsburgh, Philly, South Central, good spots to be. And then we'll also do we'll do Wisconsin in July and Michigan in September.
So how many states are you in?
Currently it's 25, and then when we add those two other states later in the year, it'll be 27.
Are you in any foreign countries?
We do export a bit of beer, and I'm not sure exactly what those countries are, but there is a bit of export going on. We are looking at ramping that up. It is definitely kind of a new frontier for a lot of craft breweries. Brooklyn Brewery is doing great things. They of course are building that brewery in Sweden in collaboration with a brewery over there and stuff like that. That's definitely something that we're looking at as well.
Oh, cool. I was going to lead into this question, but since you just talked about making a European brewery, so the first question I was going to ask was questions about the size of your brew house in Bend, Oregon, and then I was going to lead into an East Coast brewery question or something like that. So tell me about your current breweries and your potential plans.
So we actually started with very humble beginnings. We're about to celebrate our 26th anniversary this June. We started as a restaurant that made beer. Our founder, Gary Fish, and fellow co-owner at this point, because we started an ESOP program last year. We're all co-owners, which is pretty cool. He, 26 years ago, never imagined we'd ship beer to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to be honest. It was just a restaurant that made good beer, basically. That was 88. By 93... it was apparent that we were going to need to build a facility to ship beer to Portland, to Seattle, to San Francisco, that kind of thing. That production facility in 93, right down the street from the pub in Bend, Oregon, started with a 50-barrel brew house. It was a JV Northwest product, and for a long time got us where we needed to go. By the year 2005, we installed a second brew house at the production facility. It is a Hoopmann brew house out of Germany. They make world-class brew houses. And I think it was probably 2004-2005 when that brewery came online, or that brew house came online. And between those two brew houses, we produce everything for the 25 states that we're in currently.
Okay. And then you're maybe not liberty to discuss plans about foreign expansion, but you said you're thinking about doing something like Brooklyn's doing?
So we're definitely in some countries, not a lot of countries. And really, there are other people who can speak to this better than I can, to be honest. But the exporting is on the horizon. to Northern Europe, that sort of thing. I think we're also looking at expand. I think there's some beer that's going to Asia, and so we're looking at kind of ramping some of those efforts up.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the beers, your labels that you have. I remember the first time I had Deschutes beer, and this was back in 2004, I went on the All About Beer beer cruise, and this was All About Beer magazine, partnered with a travel agent in Raleigh-Durham area, you know, which is where the publisher lived. And so they had a beer cruise that left from Seattle and went up to Alaska and whatnot. And it was just a normal cruise ship where one of the groups that was on the ship was a bunch of beer geeks, but they brought in special beer for one of the bars you could go to, right? And I remember having Black Boot Porter and Mirror Pond there for the first time. And so that was the very first time I had Deschutes. And then over the years, there was a couple other opportunities. We have listeners who are great and send us beer, and they've sent us a few beers. I mentioned earlier how we have a super listener, Gary, who's sent us so much beer, including some Abyss. I've had at least 3 bottles of Abyss from him, and at least 2 bottles of Dissident. And but, you know, he also sends Black Butte and things like that. And then I went to Vegas a few years ago, and I remember picking up some Black Butte there. So let's go through your beers, your biggest selling beers, your year-rounds, things like that. Let's talk about beer.
We make a portfolio of beers. We have seven different beers that we make all year round. Not every one of those beers is available in every market, of course. But if you go to, let's say you go to Oregon, where you can find all of our beers, we make 7 different beers that we put into a 6-pack. Our best seller by far is Mirror Pond Pale Ale. It is it's the second best-selling pale ale in the country. It does very well. It's very very smooth, very easy drinking. I actually like to call this beer ubiquitous because it's good all the time, anytime, in my opinion. It pairs really well with all kinds of different foods, from very spicy foods to fish. It's just a really wonderful pale ale. And the other thing I always like to talk about with this particular pale ale is it's been around for a long time. It actually started as a seasonal for us, but way back, like 89, probably 88. Well, it wasn't 88. It was probably 89, 90. It was a seasonal. Didn't actually eclipse Black Butte Porter in sales until the year 2000. But it was designed a long time ago. A lot of the amazing pale ales that are out there these days have been designed in the last 5 years or so. The last 5 years, we've seen a hop arms race.
I was actually, my follow-up question, I'm going to interject it now because I see where you're going, was the Mirror Pond. Is it the same beer over all this time, or has it changed, right? I was just listening to some interviews with some guys from Green Flash, and, you know, their Green Flash West Coast IPA is not the same Green Flash West Coast IPA they made 10 years ago. You know, it's evolved with the times, right? So I was going to ask if Mirror Pond is a static beer, a classic beer, or whether it's a living beer that changes with the new technology, the new hops, and the arms race you just talked about.
Absolutely. I'm going to say that it's actually both. It's both a classic static beer and also an evolving beer. The reason I believe it's a classic static beer is because actually the recipe really hasn't changed. From the get-go, it's always been about one hop, the Cascade hop, which is also on the ubiquitous side, in my opinion. It's a great hop for both bittering flavor and aroma, and it's not a super big, super high alpha type of hop. It gives great flavors, great aromas, that sort of thing. This beer has always been about that identity. It's always been about a drinkable beer, a little bit of sweetness, some nice creaminess, that sort of thing. However, as I'm sure you're aware, beer is derived from agricultural products, which shift over time or change seasonally based on weather, based on soil health. You know, hops every year, the same farmer can grow Cascade hops every year, and they're going to come out just a little different. The alpha acids might be ever so slightly more or less. And so ultimately our brewmasters are responsible for not necessarily changing the recipe, but making sure the finished product stays the same. And so if that means they have to add a little more Cascade hops this year than last year, then that's what they do so that the end result is exactly the same as last year. And so in my mind, it is both a classic static pale ale and also a living thing because brewing it does require changes and evolution. And of course, there's always technology as well, both with the ingredients and the equipment. And so maybe you change the way you brew it, but that's because something is maybe more efficient or ensures a more stable product. But at the end game is to have it taste exactly the same as it did 6 months ago, a year ago, 10 years ago, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I'm drinking that right now, and it's a great drinker here. Let me take a sip here, get a fresh memory, kind of. Yeah, it has a good malt backbone. It's not too caramelly, though. It's kind of just a pale malt backbone. And then the hops you get through it, they're, like you said, Cascade. But they're not that orangey, right? They're a little more... I'm going to have to take a few more sips, but it seems like they're a little more earthy presentation of Cascades. Like, if I was tasting it blind, I might think you might have thrown some English hops in or something like that, right? And but, you know, there's a good hop flavor to it, good aroma. It definitely stands up, you know, if it's the same intensity it was, you know, 10 years ago. That was probably an aggressive beer back then, and with today's aggressive palates, it still stands up. It doesn't taste muted. It doesn't taste like it's an old beer, you know, like a beer formulated for a previous time, you know?
Right, absolutely. Well, and yes and no. I mean, I actually call it an old beer sometimes because it was designed a long time ago before that hop arms race, and so it is not that big punch you in the nose kind of pale ale that almost approaches an IPA. We make a beer like that. Mirror Pond is not that. Mirror Pond is something a little more delicate, I think, in a lot of ways. And ultimately, our beginnings back in '88, we were very much focused, or we were inspired. I should say we were inspired by English style pubs. And if you look at some of our early branding, it was traditional English style ales. And so Mirror Pond, by no means at that time, was a traditional English style pale ale, but it was inspired by those pale ales. And so some of those characteristics that are common to English style pale ales, I think, are present with Mirror Pond, but with an American twist. With a, at that point, I don't know if there was an actual Pacific Northwest twist defined, but certainly...
you mean there wasn't a West Coast IPA in 1988?
I'm pretty sure there wasn't. I'm pretty sure there was a Bridgeport IPA, which was pretty English-style IPA, actually.
Right. Okay, so that's the Mirror Pond, and then I'm guessing Black Butte's your next biggest beer.
Absolutely. Black Butte... So Mirror Pond, we call our bestseller. Black Butte Porter, we call our flagship beer. It is the beer that built the company. Back in the day, when there was Bridgeport IPA, Widmer Hefeweizen, Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, there was also Deschutes Brewery Black Butte Porter. It is what built the company, and up until 2000, it was our best-selling beer. It is a great source of pride to all of us who work at the brewery that we have a dark beer that defies... It's a great source of pride for all of us that we like to lead with Black Butte Porter, that it is our second best-selling beer. At the time that we brewed that, when we came out with this beer, at the very beginning, it was one of the three originals at the pub, no one was making a whole lot of dark beer. Everyone was scared to make a dark beer, and it's a tremendous source of pride for us that we have this amazing liquid that's been a big part of our identity since the beginning, that nobody expected to be popular, but is. At the end of the day, it is the best-selling porter in the country.
I didn't know that, so I'm glad we can get it here finally.
Yes.
I've only had it a few times, probably 4 or 5 times at most. So I'll definitely be able to try it again and have a fresh evaluation on that.
It's definitely, you know, it's definitely very smooth. There's some nice creaminess to it. Great coffee and chocolate notes without being overwhelming. It's also well balanced the way Mirror Pond is. It's got a hop profile that I think complements that malt profile nicely. Blackbeard Porter actually also has Cascade hops in it. You'd never know it, or maybe you would, depending on your palate, but it doesn't. The Cascade hops don't sing the way they do in the Mirror Pond Pale Ale. But it's a really nice balance between the malt and the hops. And ultimately, a very drinkable beer. I actually think it's a great taste bud warm-up. I like to, you know, you go out for a night and you're going to have a couple of beers. You start with an Imperial IPA, your taste buds are pretty much ruined for the rest of the night. Whereas you start with a Blackbeard Porter, you get your palate all ready for all those big beers that are coming without wrecking your palate. And so I think that Blackbeard is a perfect warm-up beer. I also think that Blackbeard is a great way to end the night because it's got a very chill vibe to it, I think, in a lot of ways for a variety of reasons. And so when I get to the end of the night, I'm like, all right, I'm going to have one more beer. What's it going to be? You know what? I'm going to chill out with a Blackbeard Porter and go home.
So I could anticipate your first two answers, but I have no idea what your third biggest selling beer is. Neither do you, apparently.
Well, you know, there are several other beers in the portfolio that all, in terms of sales, kind of are in that they're in the same bracket.
Okay.
None of them are as big as Porter or Pale.
Okay.
We make what I consider an IPA lover's IPA. It's called Inversion IPA. It's got that terrific IPA pedigree. IBUs are right there. The alcohol content's right there. But it is very balanced, like the rest of the beers that we make. And so it's got a malt backbone that mediates that bitterness and makes it very drinkable. There are a lot of amazing IPAs out there that are...
I think your phone's ringing.
I know.
Okay.
I'm going to put it away.
I mean, you can take it if you need.
No. There are a lot of IPAs out there that are amazing, but they're very, very hop-oriented. It's like drinking a glass of hops. And I love drinking those beers. I don't necessarily like drinking more than one. Inversion is different because it's so balanced.
What else is in that bracket of three?
Chainbreaker White IPA is a relatively new product for us, a new beer for us. It's a new style, certainly. Just the last couple of years, you've seen commercial examples. Also does very well for us. It is definitely an exercise in what happens when a wheat beer and an IPA get together. And, of course, there's a lovely set of Belgian wit characteristics to it as well, with the coriander, the orange peel, a Belgian yeast strain, the same strain that Hoegaarden uses.
Okay.
So that's a wonderful beer. Both those beers are doing very well. Interestingly enough, they share a common a characteristic. In 2006, when Inversion IPA came out, it was the best-selling craft beer of 2006. In 2012, when Chainbreaker White IPA came out, it was the best-selling craft beer of 2012. So that's kind of a nice thing. Both those beers do very well. Our stout offering is a beer called Obsidian Stout. It's the second best-selling craft stout in the country. However, the best-selling craft stout in the country is not as many states as Obsidian Stout is.
Is that Rogue or is it someone else?
Ninkasi Otis Stout.
Really?
Amazing, amazing beer, but that is...
They sell it by like the truckload in Oregon?
Definitely. It's a great beer. And that's the best-selling craft stout in the country. Obsidian Stout is a little different. It's not an oatmeal stout by any means. It's more, I mean, we kind of, we define it as an American stout. Exactly what that means, I'm not sure. Ultimately, it's got a little bit of sweetness, it's got a little dryness, and it's also got some terrific spiciness. The other year-round beer that we make is a is called Deschutes River Ale. It is a session ale. It's our interpretation of a session ale. 4.0 ABV. It's all about how much flavor can you pack into that package, which is not an easy thing for brewers to do. So those six beers are our year-round lineup up until this year. This year, we took a beer from our Bond Street series lineup and moved it into a year-round availability. It's called Fresh Squeezed IPA. We've been calling it Liquid Crack around the brewery because everyone is drinking it a lot.
I had that as my first beer tonight, and it has a great combination of malty carameliness, and then, you know, I couldn't really place the hop. I know the guy that was sitting there earlier called it Mosaic, so maybe that's tainting me, but as soon as he said that, I started tasting blueberries in it. So is it Mosaic? Is that what you have?
It is Mosaic. I believe it's Mosaic, Citra, and I want to say Nuggets. Yes, Citra, Mosaic, and Nuggets. It's just a fantastic beer. I think we kept the malt bill on that beer light on purpose, so it is different from the Inversion IPA. We did not want, it's a little less balanced beer than say the Inversion IPA is, but it is so incredibly satisfying for IPA drinkers.
Right.
They're looking for that big citrus.
That's interesting that you don't call it balanced. I've not had the Inversion. I thought for a West Coast IPA, I thought there was a moderate, you know, a substantial malt profile to that beer. You know, I thought it had a good balance to it. But it also had the Arms Race hops in it, right? So maybe that's it. The Arms Race hops change the game and really just give it an extra air of hoppiness.
I apologize, I misspoke. Ultimately, it is a balanced beer. I agree with you, but it's less balanced than some of the other beers that we make. We intentionally skewed it towards the hops because that is, I mean, that's definitely a West Coast style IPA characteristic. And we want, that's something that we wanted to do. That's something that we wanted to contribute to the community. And the reception has been absolutely just startling. I think it's caught everyone by surprise.
So with a beer that is that lively in the hops, I'm curious if it has a very short life. You know, do you guys take any special measures to make sure it's turned quickly, doesn't get old, doesn't hop fade? Because I could imagine a beer like that could possibly hop fade rather quickly. You know, like Lagunitas sucks. It's a fantastic beer, but it seems to fade super quickly. I just bought a Sierra Nevada IPA variety pack, one that had the black IPA, the white IPA, the Nooner, and the Torpedo. All the Torpedoes in that variety pack, completely hop-faded. It was the most disappointing thing ever. So have you noticed any hop-fade with that? Do you do anything special to make sure the customers aren't getting that beer when it's not at its prime?
We have not experienced a whole lot of hop-fading with that beer. But that said, it hasn't been sticking around. Like, ultimately, we do a lot of different things to make sure that the beer in the keg or the bottle is an amazing a product as can be, and we want that product to be amazing for about 120 days from the time it's packaged.
That's a long life for a beer that sprite. You know, I would have wondered if you guys would be trying to do a quicker turn. Maybe not the 35 days that Stone does for Enjoyberry. That's very hardcore, right? But, you know, 120 days, if that beer has that kind of shelf life, that's really good, because that's a very bright beer.
It really is. And honestly, we just haven't really encountered that issue.
Like, that's a good that's a good problem not to have.
That beer is just not sitting on the shelf. It's
that's really the, I mean, and I'm not trying to be boastful at all, it's just not sitting on the shelf. And so people it's the hottest thing in our portfolio by far.
All right, let's talk a little bit about Hophenge. Hophenge, because I told you before we started recording, I've been lucky enough to have Hophenge twice. We had a listener, Gary, who sent us a Hophenge. I don't know how many years ago, I would say 4 or 5 years ago. The label was mostly green, had green hop bales doing the thing, you know. And then today, this year, the label is much more red, right? And on the label, and in the marketing collateral we saw this time around, we did it on the show this past week, use it as an experimental platform, right? You're always trying out experimental hops, you know, different dwarf hops, things like that on it. I gather it wasn't always the experimental platform.
No, that's very true, and I apologize. I'm a little fuzzy on the number here, but I'm fairly certain that Hophenge debuted right around 06, 07, and at that time it was solely an Imperial IPA. That's what we were looking to accomplish with that beer. After a few years of making that beer, we decided to create a whole series of hop-oriented beers inspired by beers at our pub. And at this point, we talked about the Bend pub earlier. We actually have two pubs now. We have one in Portland and one in Bend. And that's where a lot of our research and development happens. We're able to create smaller batches. We have a very thirsty, critical public letting us know whether we've succeeded magnificently or failed miserably. And so the Bond Street series, beers that are inspired by the pubs on Bond Street in Bend and Davis Street in Portland, Bond Street series beers are hop forward and inspired by beers that have spent a lot of time being brewed at the pubs. And so Hophenge became part of a series of beers that function kind of like seasonals for us. In the summertime, we've done a couple of different beers. We did a black IPA. We called it a Cascadian Dark Ale. It was called Hop in the Dark. We replaced that last year, actually, with Fresh Squeezed. Fresh Squeezed did so well last year that we moved into year-round.
Okay.
In the fall, we do two different fresh hop beers, which are Dynamite. And Hophenge, at the time when we started this lineup, if you will, became the experimental platform.
Okay.
And so rather than having it be a static beer, we decided to play with it, change it up. It became that, how can we make it different each year? And so every year the alcohol content changes. Every year the hop profile changes. Every year we experiment with how to get hops into a beer. Every year we get hops that haven't been named yet, they have a number, XC971, to play with in that beer. Basically, those hop farmers and those hop conglomerates out of Yakima, Washington, come to us and say, hey, check this hop out we've been playing with. Tell us what you think of it and how it plays. And so Hophenge this year had two experimental hops in it that don't have names yet.
Right.
In addition to the rest of that hop profile. 90 IB, it's always an Imperial IPA, but we call it an experimental IPA because we're always experimenting. I remember one year, several years ago, I sat down with our brewmaster at the time and we were talking about Hophenge, and he told me that he cut hops into the mash kettle. He cut hops into the in the grist mill as the barley was getting cracked.
I was just going to make a joke about putting it into the mill.
He put it in the mill, and ultimately we love to play with hops. I would argue that we do amazing things with hops as a brewery. It's just one of the things we do well. And there's some other great breweries out there that play well with hops. Firestone Walker is something that comes to mind. They just do amazing things with hops. That brewmaster had come from the hop industry, actually, a guy named Larry Sador. And he knew his way around a hop, I guess, is what it boils down to. And so that whole group of brewers that we have really was the impetus behind. Where else can we add a hop? Right. I think that hop hinge that year probably had 8 different hop additions.
Right. So, do you have any insight on what putting hops in the mill, like, what did you think might happen? What was the hypothesis of that, you know, other than clogging up the mill and getting it all gummy?
Well, and that's what I was going to say, is that we joked at the time when we talked about it, what a huge physical material nightmare that was, because all that stuff then moves into the water tun, and it's like, whoa, this is way more material than we're used to. Can we get the liquid through that sort of thing?
So I grow hops in my yard, right? And last year I had this great idea of trying to run the hops through my meat grinder, like kind of pseudo pelletize them,
right.
And it was a sticky, tedious mess, and I ended up abandoning it like an hour in. And I had like this much crack, you know, ground up hops. So I could just imagine how your grain mill, which is a finely tuned, high speed piece of equipment, would not readily accept sticky pieces of vegetation.
It was not happy, and I'm not, don't quote me on this, but I'm fairly certain we didn't do it again the next year.
Right. It just sounds nuts. And I could see, you know, like, let's try it. But, you know, you have to have a certain expectation of it even being worth it. So my main question is, what did the brewer think he was going to get out of it? But, I mean, you probably can't answer that one.
To be honest, that conversation happened a long time ago,
right.
And I'm a little fuzzy on that particular.
I told you we were going to geek out in this interview. Didn't I tell you we were going to geek out in this interview? Sorry for asking the hard questions.
No.
But
I like to be stumped. That's way okay. If that's the question I get stumped on, I'm totally okay with that.
All right, so we're taking a long time going through your portfolio here. Let's see. We talked about Hophenge. Oh, have you ever actually made a Hophenge with hop bales in the brewery?
Actually, we did. That first year that we put it out there, this was a super fun project, really. And I don't know who came up with the idea, but... And it's really where the name came from, to be honest. Like, they decided to take the hop bales, and they're...
And the hop bales are probably 5 feet long, 6 feet long. So when they're standing on end, they're this big block. It looks like a block of stone. It's a block of burlap.
I think they're 200-pound blocks of hops. I mean, if you think about how much a single hop weighs, like 200 pounds of hops, a lot of hops. Stuffed into a burlap sack, hard like a rock. Like, you break your hand if you punch that sack, kind of thing. And they set them up down in, at the time... We have this grassy field right next to our warehouse. They set them up, and again, I don't know who came up with the idea, but they decided to recreate Stonehenge with the hop bales. And Hophenge was born.
Right.
The pictures were crazy. You could have made a calendar out of it, actually. You had brewers laying all over the hop bales. It was hilarious, really.
That's great. I was wondering if it was actually done or if it was just an illustrator's imagination of it.
No, there are pictures out there.
That's awesome.
For sure. And that label has gone through some iterations to get to where it is now. The original labels the labels always had those hop bales as Stonehenge on it.
Okay, so... trying to think. You got the... What's the Twilight called? The
Summer Ale.
Summer Ale, right. Tell us a little bit about that beer, because we didn't do it on the show proper. I'll tell you later on about how we do our pre-show and our post-show. But I had a growler, I drank some of my own, and we finished the growler off on the pre-show. But, it's a great, in my opinion, I'm thinking of it as a golden ale, summer, golden ale with more hop profile, like West Coast golden ale,
Absolutely.
And it was just a really light, refreshing drinker. It didn't seem too boozy. And a growler is a good size for that beer, I think.
You pretty much just said everything I was going to say, I'll be honest with you. Well, not everything, but You certainly captured the spirit of that beer perfectly, in my opinion. When you think summer ale, if you're going to put summer ale on a label, there are certain things that you have to adhere to.
Most of the people listening are going to think...
Exactly, and that's why this beer is different. It's not a snoozer. I think there are some summer ales out there that maybe are snoozers. Twilight Summer Ale is not. However, if you're going to do a summer ale, it's got to have a lighter body and a lighter color, I think. Certainly you can't make a black IPA and call it a summer ale. That just doesn't fly with most people. And so Twilight Summer Ale doesn't have any wheat in it, which is, I think, something that a lot of people feel should be in a summer ale. Doesn't have any wheat in it. I really think that the color and the body are certainly important, but ultimately the hop profile, it goes back to our love of the hop and whole hop flowers, I might add. We are the second largest consumer of whole hop flowers in the country. That's something that's very important to us. When we installed that Hoopman brew house, Hoopman actually designed a brew house that was non-standard for us, so that we could add whole hop flowers into the hop, into the process, both in the whirlpool and the hop kettle, the mash tun.
I like how you call it a hop kettle and not a brew kettle.
I'm sorry.
That's the shoots. They don't have a brew kettle. They just have a hop kettle.
It is a brew kettle. Everybody calls it something different, really. The hop jack, that sort of thing. We're able to add whole hop flowers into any one of the... you're obviously not going to put in a water ton, but we can add hops into any other of the vessels. And that was something that Hoopman had not done before. So we're into whole hop flowers because we love to play with hops. And Twilight Ale is no exception.
Does that use any continental hops? It seems like it has a bit of a spice to it. Continental hops, European hops, it has a bit of a spice.
There are no continental hops, actually. However, there are some U.S. Tetanangs.
Oh, okay.
And really the star of the show with the Twilight Summer Ale is the Amarillo hop. We love that hop. In fact, there's one of my favorite beers of all time at the pub is a beer called Obi Joyful that they've made for years and years and years and years. It's a single hop beer with the Amarillo hop. And it is it's delicious. It's super grapefruity. And ultimately, that we love that Amarillo hop because it provides a really nice grapefruit touch to Twilight Summer Ale. I think Twilight has a nice amount of bitterness, but not too much. Mm-hmm. It's very appropriate, I think. With beers that have a whole lot of bitterness, they tend to sit a little heavier, I think. And so Twilight Summer Ale is light. It is easy drinking because the bitterness is just right. It's very appropriate, I think. And the Amarillo hops definitely contribute to that with that citrusy grapefruit that doesn't knock you out.
It's interesting that you put so much focus on the Amarillo in your description because... The U.S. Tetanang you told me about, that's what I noticed the most when I drank it. I had it in a growler instead of a bottle, so, things are different there. But, that spicy European-type flavor from the Tetanang is what I noticed most out of that beer.
Do you gravitate towards some of those types of hops?
Not particularly. I do love a great, Bavarian Pilsner, nice spicy pils, right? So maybe I was... kind of gravitating towards that style when I was drinking your beer, so I molded it into that, used the lens to make it look like that. Maybe that's what I did. So.
Well, and ultimately, I think this beer drinks very crisply and very cleanly, much like a Pilsner would, even though it's not a Pilsner. And so, if somebody asks me for a Pilsner, I actually usually hand them this beer, if it's available at the time, because it, the flavor profile is nothing like a Pilsner, but it has some of those connotative type characteristics, I think. And certainly a little bit of European spiciness is present there, and certainly a welcome addition to the other stuff that's going on.
All right, so we're at 40 minutes already, so let's get this one wrapped up. I want to talk about Abyss before we go.
Everybody wants to talk about Abyss.
First off, when are we going to see it in Pittsburgh?
I am hoping for you that it will be here in November, December.
Oh, wow, okay. Great.
But no promises there. Don't quote me on that. The Abyss, Imperial Stout, by far our most coveted beer. 2008 was the first year. 2007, 2008 was the first vintage. We've made it every year since then. It is bourbon barrel aged. It is. It's got blackstrap molasses. It's got brewer's licorice. It's got cherry bark and vanilla bean dry hopping, or not necessarily dry hopping, but in the place of
dry beaning.
It's a work of art in my opinion, and it ages so very well. I am fortunate that I've been with the brewery a long time. I was there at the beginning of the Abyss. I have bottles from 07, 08, 09, 10. I know they're going to stand. Like, I have no fear of holding on to an 07 Abyss, because even though we really, with our Reserve Series beers, which is the Abyss is a part of, we really kind of suggest that they be consumed within 5 years for the most part. I have no fear that while it may drop off a little, 07 is still pretty delicious. It may not be as big on the tongue, but it's the flavor is still wonderful. It is the beer that everybody wants. It is the beer that everyone asks for. In my capacity as brand ambassador, introducing the brands to new markets, I don't always find new customers. I find old customers. I find folks who have been aware of Deschutes for a long time. And the number one question is, do you have any Abyss with you?
Okay, so you don't need to bring Abyss. How about some Dissident?
Oh, really? Out of the frying pan and into the fire.
Exactly.
The Dissident is also a most prized beverage. Also fairly even more elusive than the Abyss, primarily because it has been an every other year beer rather than an every year beer.
The Abyss, for people listening, it's a sour ale. It's kind of a Flanders type style, right?
The Dissident.
Did I say Abyss? I'm sorry, I misspoke. Meant the Dissident.
The Dissident is an oud brun, a Flanders style sour brown ale with sour cherries. 08, 2010, 2012, 2014. So. It is due out this year. Ultimately, that first year in 08, I take that back. In 06, when we brewed it, we weren't sure exactly how long it was going to take to be ready. And they tasted it at a year. They tasted it at 14 months. They were ready. They wanted to put it in a bottle. And every time they tasted it, they came away with this idea that, you know what, this beer is going to tell us when it's ready. Okay. And so instead of a year, it wound up being 2 years. And so that was the sweet spot for us. Aging it for 2 years rather than 12 months was what made that beer that beer. It told us when it was ready. And so that's the formula we have followed. 08, 2010, 2012, and 2014. So that beer has been the 2014 edition vintage. Usually we release it August, September. Has been aging for almost 2 years.
All right, so the last two beers we talked about are both barrel-aged beers. One's a bourbon barrel, and then the Abyss is... I'm sorry, I keep getting backwards. The Dissident keeps shaking his head at me like, you're wrong, Jeff. The Dissident is I mean, you didn't say this specifically, but it's in barrels, right? I mean, that's how you're getting the sourness out of it?
You know, it is in barrels, and we infect those barrels. The Abyss hits bourbon barrels and Pinot Noir barrels.
Okay.
The Dissident, I believe, is...
He's working here.
Oh, boy.
I would guess you would use an older barrel or maybe a wine barrel and infect that, right?
I want to say Pinot Noir, but I think I'm wrong, to be honest. I think it's actually bourbon. I can look it up.
I mean, it's not that important. The question I want to get to, and if you can, you know, you don't have to, I don't need that answer. But your barrel program, tell me a little bit about the size of your barrel program, and are there other beers that come out of it, things like that?
Absolutely. So the beers like the Abyss and the Dissident are part of what we call the Reserve Series. And they are big beers, typically over 9-10%. They're pampered beers. They're beers that have spent time aging in wooden barrels. They are beers that come in 22-ounce bottles, limited quantities, a little bit of draft. They get wax tops. Hard-to-find type beers. The Dissident and the Abyss are just two of several beers in that line. But not every beer gets made every year. So, for instance, we just released a barley wine that we've only made twice before.
Okay.
It's called Mirror Mirror Barley Wine. Inspired by Mirror Pond Pale Ale. In fact, the very first year, 05, which actually kicked off the Reserve Series line, the Mirror Mirror Barley Wine, essentially they took the Mirror Pond recipe, doubled it up, and then made a barley wine.
Right.
And so the Mirror Mirror, very smart. There's some very
good
smart
thing.
People working at the brewery.
At least in the marketing department.
Yeah, exactly. So we just released the third vintage of Mirror Mirror Barley Wine. So it came out in 05, 09, and now 2014. That was also in the wooden barrel program.
Does that go into a fresh bourbon barrel or something else?
No,
or?
Actually, that's I believe that's Pinot Noir barrels.
Okay.
I believe that...
Sorry for the hard questions.
No. These are questions I should be able to answer, actually. It's just been a while since I touched some of that stuff. We also just released a Belgian-style quad called Not the Stoic that spent time in rye whiskey and Pinot Noir.
I saw press releases on that one.
Exactly. And so that is that's a beer that we put out in 2011. We put a beer out in 2011 called The Stoic. It was a Belgian-style quad. We just released a beer called Not the Stoic, which was us having fun. When, in 2011, when we released that beer called The Stoic, a Belgian quad, there were some folks who objected to us calling it a Belgian-style quad. They felt that it didn't meet the style guidelines. I think that the brewery would argue, and I would definitely argue, that Belgian quads are hardly I hardly think that there are final guidelines for Belgian quads. At this point, I think that that style is still very much open to interpretation. And so, this year, or already in planning, this year we released a beer called Not the Stone, which definitely worked hard at being more along the lines of what folks think right now is a Belgian style quad.
Okay.
And so it was a little darker, a little sweeter, that sort of thing. But that also spent time in wooden barrels. We make a birthday beer every year. It's getting ready to come out, actually. This year, it's a double black beer porter. And we usually put some Roman numerals on the back of that based on the year, the birthday that we're celebrating. So this year it's Black Butte 26. That is always bourbon barrel, just bourbon barrels. Double Black Butte, We've added some chocolate and some pomegranate molasses this year. And that change, every year we change it up a little, but it's always got bourbon barrel aging. This year it's some chocolate, some pomegranate molasses, which was in both the Stoic and not the Stoic as well, and some cranberries.
Can you send me some?
I'm sorry?
Can you send me some?
I think we can probably arrange that. And then it's 50% bourbon barrel age. And it's just, I mean, it'll get released next month, but that's another part of the barrel program. The barrel program for us is not the largest barrel program in the country by far, but we are spending a lot of time playing with wooden barrels. It's definitely over 1,000 barrels at this point, and we're doing all kinds of things. I actually had a chance. I was just in... I don't live in Bend anymore. I used to for a while, but I was just in Bend for some meetings a couple of weeks ago, and I had a chance to tour the barrel warehouse, and we tried all of your favorite beers, actually. We tried some Dissident. We tried some...
Pulling Nails?
Exactly, and it was a wonderful experience, and they really, I mean, they have gotten very... The brewers have really gotten into playing around, and so I saw all kinds of things that we've never done before.
Right.
And in fact, one of the things that we have never done before until this year is a pub reserve series. These are beers that are only available at the pub in the wax top bottles that have the same kind of big beer barrel aging type stuff going on. Only bottles, that sort of thing. Beers that have been brewed at the pub, very small batches, that kind of thing. But we're playing with a lot of barrels.
Very cool.
Do you treat the Dissident special? Do you keep it sequestered away so it doesn't infect other things, anything like that?
It has its own little environment, absolutely. It's a very dangerous thing at the end of the day for a brewery to take on sour beers when you make things other than sour beers.
Are there any other sour beers in that family?
Yeah, actually, it's funny you should ask. We put a beer out called the Green Monster. And that was an interesting beer. We used to make an organic beer called Green Lakes Amber Ale. We don't anymore, for a variety of reasons. I'm not gonna...
The name was the death knell, I'm sure.
I'm not gonna get into the details there, but ultimately, at some point in the past, a brewer made a mistake and put some... And some Green Lakes wound up getting some non-organic malt. We're not going to sell that as an organic beer, but we didn't necessarily want to dump it either. Somebody said, hey, why don't we throw it in some wooden barrels and sour it? Spent 2 years in barrels souring. And last year we released it as the Green Monster because it used to be Green Lakes and it was... Again, some very smart marketing folks, for sure. So that's a terrific beer. Up to this point, those are really the only two. There is a Pub Reserve Series beer that just got released that is also like the Dissident. It's a sour brown called Planet Rouge, but it's only available at the pubs, basically. But we just play. We really, I mean. Just some amazing things with our brewers. We have a team of brewers at this point. We've got 2 brewmasters. We've got 5 assistant brewmasters. We've probably got a team of 20 staff brewers that get together on a weekly basis and argue over how to make a beer, argue over how to make a good beer, argue over how to make a bad beer, argue over what is a good beer and what is a bad beer. The end result of all that is some pretty amazing beer that comes out of the brewery.
Well, we are at 55 minutes, believe it or not. I could talk with you for another hour, but I'm not sure anyone wants to listen to that. So I think we'll end the recording. Thank you, Eric.
It has been a pleasure, Jeff. I truly appreciate the time. And I want to thank you and all your listeners for this grand thing that we're doing here with craft beer, because it truly is a community. We are all in it together. Without every listener, without you doing what you do, without this bar that we're in doing what they do, without us doing what we do, we wouldn't have craft beer, and that would be a terrific, terrific, terrible thing.
Sounds good. I agree. So it was great spending time with you, and thanks a lot.